version of Sage? Can I just rename the folder or something?
It's not included with what you have for files. There are a whole bunch of files that end with .lib. And it's actually easy to fix. You just have to stick these list of files and then something. I mean, let's just say a list of like 30 files, they're just plain text files. If you stick them to the right subdirectory of your Sage install, it'll work. And I can give you a parball that has those files in it.
Okay.
So yeah, it is easy to fix. It's not easy to fix that downloading and putting an additional thing in. But it's the stupid singular install. It notices that there's already a lib directory, but it's a lowercase lib directory instead of the uppercase lib directory that it creates. So singular normally installs its stuff in a directory that's called lib. But if it notices a directory already there with that name, it just, for whatever reason, doesn't do anything. It just skips that step. And it notices the lib directory, and it fails. And actually, in Windows, it's also a problem. Again, because Windows is not case sensitive either. So, look. Have you figured out anything yet so far? I mean, totally, because you're... It's a weird, singular is weird, isn't it?
It is, because you have to set the current ring. And
yeah.
The stuff that you made from before, so really you can't do anything with it. You can only move it into the new ring.
Right.
There's weird stuff like that.
Yeah.
Very strange and hideous.
Yeah,
design.
The point is to somehow figure out how to use that very powerful, it's incredibly powerful system. It has a lot implemented in it, but...
I'm just going through the tutorial, and as soon as I finish that, I'll try to learn how to actually do import the functionality.
Also, a really good thing I think for the Sage documentation is to have the examples from the tutorial, but the same examples that are in the singular tutorial done in Sage,
right.
And then those can be included. So if you can figure out how to do them via the Sage interface, then I think that's a very useful thing to add to the documentation.
Yeah.
I mean, I did that a little bit when I was writing the documentation, but you'll notice that I kind of ran out of energy. But that would be a good thing for you to do. So, do you have your midterm? Everybody does. Good. All right, well, I think I'll start. There's a new version of the notes. So, we should. So, today we're going to tell you precisely what a modular form is in general. So the goal today is to define what it means to be a modular form of weight k where k is an integer for a congruent subgroup gamma. And I'll try to be very precise in everything I do today. So this won't, at no point should this be a hand-waving definition. It should be a rigorous definition. So let's get started. First, I'll tell you what a congruent subgroup is. You already know what an integer is. So you just need to know what a congruent subgroup is, and of course what a modular form is. So here's what a congruent subgroup is. For each positive integer n, there's an interesting subgroup of SL2Z, namely gamma of n. This is a positive integer. Gamma of n is by definition the kernel of the reduction homomorphism from SL2Z to SL2Z mod nZ. So this homomorphism is the one that sends a 2x2 matrix to that matrix, but with its entries reduced modulo n. See, this is also a group. Here, this is the group of 2x2 matrices with determinant 1, but where the entries are in Z mod nZ. And you have a group homomorphism. It's a theorem that is not trivial, but isn't too difficult, that this map is surjective, which is not trivial. Somehow non-trivial means more difficult than not trivial. I don't know why, but this is not quite a trivial fact. I remember being somewhat frustrated by this the first time I saw it for a few minutes. So it's actually true for any n. So you have a homomorphism, and its kernel, it's a normal subgroup of SL2Z. By the way, there is a new version of the NICs. So do you want to look at this? And then turn in your midterm. So you have this homomorphism, and its kernel is a normal subgroup of SL2Z. It has finite index. Why does it have finite index as a subgroup? Quick proof. What? So question, why does gamma then have finite index in SL2Z? So we can figure out why that is the fastest. I have to find a subgroup of a group, namely the kernel of that homomorphism, and that subgroup has finite index, meaning that the quotient group is finite. So how can you prove that?
So that's yes. Got the projection map from SL2Z onto SL2Z mod NZ?
Yes. Reduction modulo n of each component of the matrix.
What do you mean? So it's 2.
What is 2?
I mean just, SL2Z mod NZ is finite.
That's correct. That's the proof. Perfect. This group is finite because it's a subset of the set of all 2x2 matrices over Z mod NZ. And these are just 4 tuples of elements of Z mod NZ. So there are only finitely many of them. They're exactly n to the fourth elements here. So this has some cardinality which is less than equal to n to the fourth. So the subgroup has to be finite index because when you quotient out by it, you get a subgroup to actually get exactly the group SL2 Z mod NZ, which is a finite group. So this is finite index because this group is finite. Okay, so this is gamma n. Now here's the definition of a congruent subgroup. A subgroup gamma in SL2Z is a congruent subgroup if gamma contains gamma n for some n. And if you have a congruent subgroup, the level of the congruent subgroup is the smallest n that works. The level of gamma is the minimal such n. As I just observed, all of these congruent subgroups, they're a new copy of the notes, but all of these congruent subgroups are of finite index in SL2Z. So you have SL2Z, and then you have a whole bunch of, so this is the modular group, which has something to do with modular forms. You have a whole bunch of these finite index subgroups that contain gamma of n, or some n, and these are called the congruent subgroups of SL2Z. It's not the case that every finite index subgroup of SL2Z is a congruent subgroup. A finite index subgroup, either it may or may not be, either thing can happen. And it's actually a very interesting question. If you describe a subgroup of SL2Z, for example, by giving a list of generators, a list of elements of SL2Z, and saying take the group generated by it, it's an interesting and potentially difficult question to decide whether or not the thing that you're looking at is a congruent subgroup.
Has that been characterized?
Just there, I think there's an algorithm.
Okay.
Yeah, there's an algorithm. I don't know a simple description of any non-congruent finite index subgroups. I mean, simple in the sense that I could just tell you one right off. But I have seen them. I mean, well, I guess I could. I just couldn't. It'd be hard to describe. I can't remember off the top of my head. Whereas I can give you a load of examples of congruent subgroups. That's really easy. But there are. There's an algorithm that allows you to decide. I don't remember the exact reference off the top of my head. But you can decide at least whether or not something's a congruent subgroup. But usually the non-congruent ones are fairly complicated looking. But they are very interesting to study as well. And you do have objects similar to modular forms for those. And there's a whole theory. And people like Swinnerton, Dyer, and others have studied them in depth. Yes?
I'm sorry, I don't understand. SL2Z.
Yes.
It's not a subgroup of SL2Z.
You're correct. It's a quotient group. It's this whole kernel that's a subgroup of SL2Z.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry. The whole thing. Did I completely answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay, excellent. So we're going to study in this course, for the rest of this course, modular forms that are on or for congruent subgroups of SL2Z. So these are what we'll focus on. And it's pretty easy to describe congruent subgroups, at least. Well, here's what you do. If you have a congruent subgroup, it contains, by definition, gamma of n for some n. So you have your group, and it's sitting here between SL2Z and gamma of n. Now, you just take this, and you can quotient out by n. You can consider the reduction map, SL2ZYNZ here. And gamma of n just reduces to the identity group right here. And your gamma reduces to some group. I'll call it gamma bar. You have inclusions like that. And a basic fact from group theory is that the groups between a big group and a normal subgroup are in bijection with the subgroups of the quotient. So the congruent subgroups of level n, these are in one-to-one correspondence with the subgroups of the group SL2Z mod nZ. And SL2Z mod nZ, that's a completely, I mean, it's a finite, as a set, it's just a finite set. You could list all of the elements very easily with a computer if you wanted to, especially for small n. So you could describe, certainly, with no difficulty, at least in theory, any subgroup of SL2Z mod nZ. Just give a list of all of its elements, for example. And by doing that, you've then described, since you can describe the subgroups of this group, you equivalently describe the subgroups of SL2Z. So here are some examples of congruent subgroups of SL2Z that are of extreme interest in the theory of modular forms. So there are two groups that are this new version. Throw away the second half of the notes from Boston. So examples. So here's one. You take gamma 1 of n, and that's the group of 2 by 2 matrices in SL2Z that, when you reduce them modulo n, they're in the form 1, and then you don't care what's in the upper right corner, and then 1 mod n. See, if you take all matrices of the form 1 star 0 1, that's just the group generated by the matrix 1 1 0 1 modulo n. It's a subgroup of SL2Z mod nZ. Gamma 1 of n is simply the inverse image of that subgroup in SL2Z. So this is an example, again, of a congruent subgroup. It's just the inverse image of the group generated by what I call T bar. That's the group generated by the matrix 1, 1, 0, 1. Anytime you give a subgroup of SL2Z mod nZ, you give a congruent subgroup of SL2Z. And that's one example. That is really the most important example by far in the theory of modular forms. And this is where we'll find them all. The reason that this one is so important is that if you consider subgroups of GL2Q, then any congruent subgroup can be conjugated to be via some element of GL2Q to be a subgroup of some gamma 1 of n for some n. So you can always, via conjugation, you can get any congruent subgroup to be inside of one like this. And hence, that's an indication that any theory we develop, well, if we can prove everything, if we can really understand gamma 1 of n well, then we'll be able to understand everything, all the congruent subgroups. That's what happens in practice. Okay, quick question. Is gamma 1 of n in general for any n, is that a normal subgroup of SL2Z? Completely equivalent question. Is this subgroup, the subgroup of matrices of the form 1 star 0 1, is that a normal subgroup of SL2Z mod nZ? Does it say, is it preserved under conjugation or equivalently change of basis? So what do you think? is this group normal? For n equals 1 it is, but in general. Any ideas at all?
So you guys know gamma 1?
Yes. Is gamma 1 then a normal subgroup of SL2Z? Where, for those of you who don't know group theory, normal means that for any matrix, for all matrices S in, well, all matrices capital A and SL2Z is A gamma 1 of N, A inverse, is that equal to gamma 1 of N?
Yes.
Okay, why do you think that?
I think it's characteristic. Is it characteristic?
The characteristic polynomial is preserved under conjugation, that's true.
Oh, no, like a characteristic subgroup, like a fixed biomorphism? Because you described it?
No, but good guess. I don't know what that means, actually, characteristic subgroup.
It's a subgroup that's preserved by automorphisms.
Okay, well, I think that's the same. That's what I mean by a normal subgroup. So, this is an inner automorphism, so it's a little bit special.
A normal subgroup
is preserved by inner automorphisms.
Yeah, a characteristic is by any automorphism.
Okay, so no, this isn't a character. That's not.
It's strong in normality, but implies normality.
Yeah, but this is not a characteristic subgroup, or whatever that is. Okay. So, any other ideas? Anything at all? You have a 50-50 chance if you just guess. What do you want to say?
Yes.
Okay. But just because it would be nice, right? It's good to have a normal subgroup. It makes life easier, usually.
Write down the conjugation.
Okay, let's try it. So, I'm going to take a special matrix, like you said, take this matrix, and I'm going to conjugate it by something. We had another matrix, that one. I'll conjugate it by that matrix. Is that inverse? Yeah. Okay, so I'm conjugating an element of gamma 1 of n by an element of SL2Z. And let's see what we get. So I get 0, minus 1, 1, 1. And here you get 1, 0, minus 1, 1. And is that in gamma 1 of n? No. Doesn't matter what your n is, well, n equals 1 would be better. This is not in gamma 1 of n for n greater than 1. That one doesn't. So now what do you think?
No.
Okay, no. Gamma 1 of n is not a normal subgroup except for n equals 1, as we've just proved. The answer is no. So you have to watch out, because there are a lot of things that are true about normal subgroups, like it makes sense to form the quotient group, which will not hold for gamma 1 of n. You cannot make sense of SL2Z. You can make sense of it, but it's not a group. If you consider the set of cosets, SL2Z mod gamma 1 of n, this is not a group. Makes sense, but not a group. Not. It's just a set. So watch out. So that's one example of a congruent subgroup. Another example is gamma 0 of n. The definition is almost the same, except instead of taking matrices that are from 1 star 0 1, you take matrices of the form star star 0 star. That is your upper triangular mod n. That's gamma 0 of n. Is that a normal subgroup?
No.
right? It's not a normal subgroup. There's an element of gamma 0 of n. When we conjugated it, it's that in gamma 0 of n. So the same thing shows again that it's not a normal subgroup. So it says, again, it's a congruent subgroup, and it's not a normal subgroup. What is the level of the congruent subgroup gamma 0 of n? Here's the definition of level. So does anybody have the levels? Oh, you have to look on your face like that's
totally obvious. N?
Yeah, you're right,
N.
But you have to check something, right?
Yeah.
Well, you need to know that gamma naught of N isn't contained in gamma of M for some smaller N. Isn't contained, it doesn't contain, sorry. You need to show that it doesn't contain. It's certainly the case that gamma 0 of n contains gamma of n. So the level is less than or equal to n. But without any further thought, we might worry that maybe there's an m such that gamma of m is containing gamma 0 of n, and m is smaller than capital N. But let's see. That wouldn't be the case because every single element of gamma 0 of n has lower left entry divisible by n. However, gamma of m, that's all the matrices that are the identity mod m. So if m is smaller than n, you can consider the element 1m01. This is an element of gamma of m, but it's not in gamma 0 of n if m is smaller than n, because this lower left entry is divisible by n, and it would also be less than n, hence it would have to be 0. So you're right, the level is n. The answer is n. What about for gamma 1 of n? What's the level of gamma 1 of n?
Isn't it just the same?
Yep, it's exactly the same. You're right. Exactly the same argument tells you the level of gamma 1 of n is n also. So we have two congruent subgroups. All right, now let me tell you what modular forms are. I'll define them for any congruent subgroup, but we will be specifically interested in modular forms for each of these two congruent subgroups. And I'll give the definition in general. The main reason I gave the definition of these right now and ask you some questions about them is so that you'll have some feeling for congruent subgroups so that when I talk about them in the context of defining modular forms, there's something that's familiar to you after having thought about them for 15 minutes.
So just a
yes.
Question.
Please.
So when you're mapping from SL2Z to SL2Z mod NZ,
mm-hmm.
you're just taking mod of every element.
That's right.
There's nothing special.
Nothing at all. Yeah.
And
it's
that
just,
works nicely. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's surjective. Good exercise. It's a surjective homomorphism. It's not obvious. If you want to really understand the homomorphism, prove it's surjective.
It's not obvious.
It's not obvious. Why isn't it obvious? Take a matrix. A, B, C, D, and if it's in SL2Z mod NZ, that means that AD minus BC is congruent to
one mod N.
Mod N.
Maybe.
So you have to prove that there's some way of adjusting A, B, C, and D by adding multiples of N, so that in fact it's equal to one, not just congruent to one. That's not obvious, is it?
No.
Okay. It's true. Not obvious. And the surjectivity, in fact, will be very important for modular symbols algorithms that I will be telling you guys about at some point in the future,
so that
whether or not I get to it in the course. Yes?
So it equals 1 plus
yeah.
kn.
That's right.
And you want to get the kn on the other side, too.
That's right. Yeah.
That's pretty.
Yep. You can do it. But you have to think about it a little. Okay, so first, mimicking last time, a weakly modular function of weight k, the definition is going to be exactly the same, but instead of SL2Z, we put a congruent subgroup. So I can just Thanks for the definition.
A weakly modular function of weight k for or on, just what people say, a congruent subgroup gamma is a neuromorphic function f from the upper half plane to complex numbers such that f bar gamma k, I'll remind you what that means in a second in case you forgot from last time, is equal to f for all gamma in our congruent subgroup capital gamma. Here, what this means is that, so just explicitly again, it's exactly the same as last time, for all z in the upper half plane, and all gamma equals a, b, c, d, we have that cz plus d minus k, f of az plus b over cz plus d is equal to f of z. And remember, though this looks like a bizarre and sort of strange and bizarre expression, it really just says, this is really just f of z dz to the k over 2, at least in the case when k is even. So it's really just a it's not equal to that, but if you take f of z dz to the k over 2, then the statement that you have equality here is the same as the statement that that differential is invariant under replacing z by az plus b over cz plus d. So this is a definition which doesn't involve differentials, but simply mimics some property of differentials being invariant under a group action. It's just completely, but it completely avoids having to use that language. Okay, so any questions about this definition? It's exactly the same as last time. The only difference is that gamma is that you make this condition for elements in a congruent subgroup rather than in all of SL2Z. One crucial thing though to keep in mind here, last time when gamma was equal to SL2Z, I observed that you'll never have a non-zero form like this, or function, you'll never have a non-zero function like this when k is odd, because the group SL2Z contains the matrix minus 1, 0, 0, minus 1. That's a perfectly good matrix with determinant 1 and integer entries. And if you consider this condition with that particular matrix, you get let's see what you get. If you use this matrix, then you would get, here, you have minus 1 to the minus k, and you have f of, minus z divided by minus 1, so just z, equals f of z. So that says, if k is odd, that says minus f of z is equal to f of z, which means f of z is 0. So when k is odd, you don't have any weakly modular functions except the zero function for SL2Z. However, congruent subgroups typically don't contain this matrix. For example, gamma 0 of n or gamma 1 of n. Let's see. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. Exactly one of these two groups contains this matrix for all n, and the other one doesn't. Which one? Should be an easy question. The one on the top. Gamma 0 of n does contain minus 1, 0, 0, minus 1 because of the conditions like this. On the other hand, gamma 1 of n, at least for n greater than 2, does not contain that matrix because it's of this form. If you have a number, if you have a number n and minus 1 is congruent to 1 modulo n, then n has to be either 1 or 2. So what I just observed for you is that if you have a weakly modular function on gamma 0 of n, and its weight is odd, and it's the zero function, because you have this matrix in there. But if it's a weakly modular function on gamma 1 of n, and the weight is odd, you can't say anything. It might very well be there. There could be some. And in fact, there is, as it turns out, there are lots and lots and lots of weakly modular functions of odd weight for gamma 1 of n. So once you fail to have this matrix in your congruent subgroup, then you're given the chance, you're allowed, your congruent subgroup is small enough that you could potentially have forms of odd weight, and in practice you do. So you do get lots and lots of interesting modular forms of odd weight. That's what we'll see. Okay, so that's the definition of a weakly modular function. In order to define modular form, what I did last time is I said, well, a modular form is a function that's a weakly modular form. It's holomorphic on the whole upper half plane, and holomorphic at infinity. In order to make sense of holomorphic at infinity, I introduced a notion of Q expansion for a modular form that was given by considering a function on the open unit disk and asking for it to have a power series with no terms that have negative exponent. So we had a notion, well, a modular form was then a weakly modular function that's holomorphic on the upper half plane and holomorphic at infinity. That's not quite enough here. Here you'll need more than just holomorphic on the upper half plane and at infinity. So I'll introduce the notion of cusps in order to explain the extra thing that you need. Set Q union infinity. This is the set of cusps. So this is called. So you should think of the Q here as being the rational numbers on the real line. And the infinity is, you should think of it as being at infinity along the y-axis. And these points are with respect to the appropriate choice of a metric called the Poincaré metric on the upper half plane. These are the, well, if you throw in these points, then you get a compact Riemann surface, or you have the upper half plane structure of Riemann surface. So, but you have to throw in these points. Well, it's not really a Riemann surface. I mean, it's sort of funny. It's not exactly a Riemann surface because it's it's not closed, but it's sort of almost a Riemann surface. It's more of a covering, but yeah, universal covering. Yeah.
So if you're saying like P1 of Q, so I'm used to thinking P1 of Q as being the infinity lies out along that one real axis.
Think about it up now instead.
Okay, but then what's out? Is it also out?
That's not.
It's not.
This just loops around.
Oh, okay.
Around that way. You should think of the upper half plane as being a circle with the cusps on the outside, and these are the geodesics, the passive minimum length. And this corresponds to things like this here. And also, this is a geodesic, a vertical line that goes to infinity.
Okay. So infinity is the center, infinity is the center of that disk. And then
you're right. Infinity is the center. Yeah.
And you have to throw in another point though to make that circle, or just wrap that around us? Like on the real axis?
Infinity is the center. I'm not sure that infinity. I think that.
Well, isn't it just a circle?
I think it's just another point on the outside.
Like
P1 R. Yeah, I infinity is not the center. I is on the outside. Okay. There is an infinity going this way, but they get with this metric they get identified, I think.
Okay.
So, So what's your comment?
Wait, isn't just P1 of R just the circle? Mm-hmm.
Topologically, yes.
And then so isn't P1 of Q?
Well, by this I mean the rational points on. So here it is.
Rational.
It is just rational. But this is algebraic, not topological. So. If you identify P1 of R with a circle, then P1 of Q would be a subset of that circle. And the points would be in bijection with the rational numbers and one extra point. Which would, the extra point would correspond to whatever your point at infinity is in P1 of R in your circle. Okay. So, let's see, is there any, I think. See, the thing is, there's no point in infinity going out sideways because you want to have geodesic paths. There's supposed to be a geodesic path between any of these extra points that you added, between any two points. There's supposed to be a path of finite relative to this metric that I haven't written down. And you can't go like that or something. It just doesn't make sense. I think it's better to come back to this discussion when I give a precise definition of the Poincaré metric on the upper half plane. Okay? So I'll delay it until then. So the set of cusps are, by definition, the rational numbers along this axis and one extra point at infinity. And for example, if you consider the quotient of the upper half plane by the action of SL2z, remember you get the Riemann sphere, but with one point missing. And these cusps, they all map to that one point that's missing. In fact, all the cusps are equivalent modulo the action of SL2z. You can get from any cusp to any other cusp via an element of SL2z via linear fractional transformations. The thing with this infinity is just, it's basically the one point at infinity in the whole complex plane. Maybe that's the right way to think about it. So let me figure it out actually. So lemma, if alpha and beta are cusps, then there's a gamma in SL2z such that gamma of alpha equals beta. All the cusps are identified under the action via linear fractional transformations of SL2z. Okay, so let's prove this. So it suffices to consider the case when one of the two is equal to the point at infinity. Because if I can get from any cusp to the point at infinity, then I can get from any cusp to any other cusp. I just take the matrix that goes from my point to the point at infinity, and then the matrix that goes from the other point to the point at infinity, invert that, and then I compose the two. And that gets me from here to here. Okay? So without loss, soon, data is infinity. Okay? And we'll write alpha equals A over B, where that's in lowest terms. So A and B are integers, and they're coprime. Okay, now, I might for simplicity do it backwards. Actually, a little easier to do it backwards. So I'm going to switch these around. Beta is A over B, and alpha is infinity. Okay, now, since A and B are coprime, you can use the extended Euclidean algorithm to find C and D so that is a matrix with determinant 1. So if C and D exist, there exists C and D such that A, B, C, D is an SLTC just by the extended Euclidean algorithm. That says that if you have two numbers and their GCD is G, then there's a way of writing them explicitly, 1 plus something times 1 plus something times the other equals G. So you do that with the fact that A and B have GCD 1, and you get a matrix in SLTC. Now let's figure out what this matrix takes infinity to. We want that gamma of infinity is equal to beta. So let's compute gamma of infinity. This is via the action of linear fractional transformations. So you have to be a little clever to understand what is meant by gamma of infinity, but that's not too bad. So this is supposed to be the limit as, say, z goes to infinity of ac plus b over cz plus d, and you divide the top and the bottom by z, you write this as the limit as z goes to infinity of a plus b over z, divided by c plus d over z. And now that's nice because b over z goes to 0 and d over z goes to 0, so this is just a over c. Oh, yeah. That's wrong. I actually wrote this incorrectly, sorry. This should be AZ plus C over BZ plus D. So that's A over B, which is beta, which is exactly what we wanted. This gamma takes infinity to beta. So you can get from any cusp to any other cusp using elements of SL2Z.
So gamma acts on... So gamma acts on any point just by that thing.
Yeah, that's the formula. It's the linear fractional transformation formula. So I only discussed it acting on the upper half plane, but actually GL2C acts on the whole complex plane. And this is a particular element of, this is a particular 2x2 matrix, and it acts on the whole complex plane, so in particular it acts on any rational numbers. And you can extend that action to an action on the complex plane union infinity. Actually, I just lied slightly because, well, linear fractional transformations don't act on the whole complex plane because they could send something to infinity. For example, the linear fractional transformation z goes to, minus 1 over z, that sends 0 to infinity. So if you just restrict to the open upper half plane, you do have an action of linear fractional transformations on that set. But if you include additionally, if you include other points in the complex plane, such as the points along the x-axis, then you have to throw in the point in infinity in order to have an action. You only get an action on the complex numbers union infinity. And that's and the way you do it is it's defined in the usual way, except in the case when you substitute in infinity, then you have to be careful, and it's just this quotient. And also, if the denominator is zero, then you get infinity. So generalizing this, you can consider the set of cusps for a congruent subgroup. So
that limit as z goes to infinity,
mm-hmm.
I mean, what is that? What does that mean?
Okay, so it's just in the sense of calculus. Just to emphasize this, I mean on the i-axis. So precisely I mean this to be the limit as z goes to infinity along the i-axis. We get a sequence of complex numbers?
No, along the i-axis.
Yeah, now it's precise. Yeah. Though if you were to go along a different axis, what if you went along the real axis?
You still get zero.
I mean, you still get these two become zero, so you get a over b. This doesn't really matter, but... it doesn't matter which axis you go along, but it's well-defined regardless of how you take the limit. But let's say that I'm taking the limit as z goes to I infinity.
If you went along the real axis,
yeah,
then the limit would still equal that, but that's not the infinity that you're interested in, right? Because you said that you don't get to this point of infinity by going along.
No, I don't want to. Yeah, I don't think
so. Like that.
This is what I mean. Yeah, this is what I mean. Okay. This is what I want. Okay, so now here's a definition. C of gamma, this is the set of cusps for gamma. It is the set of
orbits of gamma acting on P1Q. Which could also be denoted, it's a left action, so gamma slash P1Q.
A set of gamma orbits. It's the you take an element of P1 of Q, and then you see, consider all things that are equivalent to it in the sense that you can get from one to the other via an element of gamma, and then you take the set of such equivalence classes, and that's the C of gamma. And an example, just a way of restating the lemma, is C of SL2Z. It's a set of one element, namely the cusp infinity, or any other, I mean, you can choose any specific element of P1 of Q, it's the class of that element. Everything's equivalent. There's exactly one cusp for SL2Z. SL2Z has one cusp. Let's see, what are the general facts? So the set of cusps for a Kalman subgroup is a finite set. So this is finite. That's because of what we just proved, and that congruent subgroups are finite index subgroups. I won't say more about that. Actually, computing the set of cusps can be an interesting question. It's not completely trivial. So slightly surprising, the description. And you can have, the set can be really big. The fact that you have cusps for these groups, that this extra structure turns out to be the by far the most important and crucial fact for doing efficient algorithms for computing with modular forms. And there's an analog of everything I'm doing, which involves quaternion algebras. You replace SL2Z by an order in a certain quaternion algebra. And then again, this quaternion algebra, you can embed it in GL2R, you can embed it in M2 of R with positive determinants, so you do get an action on the upper half plane again of this quaternion algebra. And formally, a whole bunch of the same theory that I'll describe for modular forms in this classical setting goes through, but unfortunately, there's no notion of cusps there. The elements of P1 and Q, they're not acted on by this quaternion algebra, and you don't have anything to grab a hold of. Here you have this nice, discrete, well, after taking the quotient, I mean, you have this nice, not discrete, but you have this nice, what is actually discrete? You have this nice discrete set of points. They're discrete relative to the right trace of a topology on the upper half plane union P1 of Q. It's called H star. Because the open sets are like this. You just include one cusp and then they go out. We have this nice set of points that, in this case, in the congruent subgroup case, on which your group acts. And that allows you to do a huge amount of computation and prove a lot of things that you couldn't prove otherwise. In the case of Shimura curves and Hilbert modular forms, where you don't have this structure, the situation is much, much more complicated. So, just a little aside. These cusps are crucial to modular forms algorithms. And the natural situation in which you don't have them, which is of great interest again, is the case of Shimura. I'll just throw up a bunch of words. Shimura curves, quaternion algebras. Hilbert modular forms. And in this context, there is also a good theory for computing, but it's not as good. It's less than in goodness to the theory I'll describe for classical modular forms. So that was the definition of cusps. So now back to the definition of modular form. Here's the definition. A holomorphic function on the upper half plane is a modular form. If it's holomorphic, if it satisfies the transformation condition f, you know, bar, if it's a, so I'll forget about how to say it. A weakly modular function is a modular form if it's holomorphic on the upper half plane and holomorphic at all the cusps. So I have to just tell you what holomorphic at the cusps mean. I still haven't told you that. But at least I told you what the cusps are. They're P1 and Q. And really, you just need to check this holomorphicity condition after finding any cusps for your congruent subgroup. So let me tell you what it means to be holomorphic at a cusp.
Definition.
Yes, please.
So the cusps, so this is, so we say H star is the upper half plane union that?
Yes.
That's a disjoint union?
Yes.
That's, okay, so these aren't, so cusps aren't, they're not in like just a rational point.
Yes.
Sitting in the upper half plane.
Yeah, so this is H union P1 of Q. Here's a picture of it. It's the whole upper half plane. Disjoint union, the rational numbers that are sitting along the x-axis, and then throw in one other point, infinity up here. That is H star. Okay. And there is a topology on the upper half plane so that you have open sets that look like this, and somehow the limit points are these extra cusps that we've thrown in. This is a natural compactification of the upper half plane with respect to the Poincaré metric.
Okay.
So these are the extra points you have to throw in to get something that's compact. I mean, it doesn't look compact because it goes off forever this way, but don't worry about that. It's, if, with the right metric, it doesn't go off forever that way.
And the Poincaré metric is just the metric on the upper half.
Yes, it's a metric on the upper half, which I will not describe yet, but I will describe later if there's sufficient interest. It's a way of defining distances. So I want to define what it means to be holomorphic at a cusp. And in order to do that, I will do two things. I'll first focus on infinity again, just like before. So there's actually an interesting subtle point that comes up at this stage. So remember with SL2z, we had f of z plus 1 equals f of z. Any f that is a weakly modular function for SL2z had this property, which I wrote incorrectly several times last time. This is it. So this was if f is weakly modular for SL2z. And the reason that this holds is simply because the matrix 1, 1, 0, 1 is in SL2Z. It's one of the generators, in fact, that we considered. And if you just look at the definition of weakly modular, you immediately see that this is satisfied. The fact that F had this property allowed us to write F as a formal power series. Well, actually, first, the fact that F had this property allowed us to write F of Z equals capital, let me use a different letter than I did last time just because I'm talking. Capital G of Q, where we view Q as being a variable on the open unit disk. And you have this Q gives you a map from this infinite vertical strip between 0 and 1, gives you an isomorphism between that and the open unit disk, the origin removed. So Q gave. So our function is periodic with period 1, and the strip, which completely determines our function, is isomorphic to this open unit, or whatever the word for holomorphically equivalent is. What is the word for when two domains are equivalent via an invertible holomorphic map? I don't know. Does anyone know?
Holomorphic.
I just read it was like an analytic correspondence between them.
Oh, okay.
They just write, maybe there's no. What the word is.
Biholomorphically continuous. I don't know. Anyways, these two are, there's a map, though, there's a bijection between them that is holomorphic in both directions. So if you have a function on just here, you can do it as a function on here. And then we said that it was holomorphic if the function on here extended to a holomorphic function at the origin. So this G has to be holomorphic with the origin. Now there's a problem with this, with generalizing this, because 1, 1, 0, 1 need not be in our congruent subgroup. So a weakly modular function for a congruent subgroup doesn't have to be periodic with period 1. So that's potentially a problem. But don't fear, because
first of all, you write the tail of the problem. It's not a problem for gamma 0 or gamma 1, but it is a problem in general. 1, 1, 0, 1 need not be in gamma. This means need not. There's, for example, if gamma is equal to gamma of n, then 1, 1, 0, 1 is not in gamma. And you might say, well, just don't bother defining things except for gamma 0 and gamma 1. But in fact, I can't give the definition for gamma 0 and gamma 1 without dealing with this, as you'll see in a minute. So you really have to deal with this. Fortunately, gamma contains, by definition, it's a congruent subgroup that contains gamma of n for some n. Therefore, this matrix, 1n, 0, 1, this isn't gamma. So though your function f, your weakly modular function, isn't periodic with period 1, it will at least be periodic with period n. It'll actually be periodic for some period that divides n, for some integer that divides n. So at least you have this. And what that allows you to do, this gives you, instead of n, I'll put h, where h is the minimal one for the minimal h for which that's true. So where 1h01 is in gamma, and h is greater than 0. For example, if gamma is gamma 0 of n or gamma 1 of n, h is take h equal to 1. But in general, if gamma were, for example, gamma of n, then you'd have to take h equal to n, because no smaller one would work. So you do have this periodicity, and what that gives you is that f of z is equal to, well, it's not a function of q, but it is a function of q to the 1 over h. You know, a power series expansion in terms of 1 over h. So it's not quite as good, but it's pretty close. So remember, q is e to the, or this function over here is e to the 2 by z, and q to the 1 over h is thus q to the 1 over h, so that's just a holomorphic function of z. It's e to the 2 pi I z over h. So all we're doing is, I guess, somehow composing with z goes to z over h to get a function of periodic with period 1. And then we use the usual idea. So so the picture's like this. You have your function f, it's a weakly modular function for a congruent subgroup gamma, and it's periodic with period h. It's kind of annoying, but you can consider the map z goes to, I might have this backwards, so we'll see. Maybe it's z goes to 1 over hz, and then this, that's an invertible holomorphic map, just rescaling, and that sends this strip to the strip of width 1. That strip goes to this strip, and then you use the q again. Q equals e to the 2 pi I z. And that takes you to the open unit disk. So you just compose these two. And we take the inverse. We compose in the other direction to get this function capital G. That's a function on the open unit disk. And going in the other direction, that's e to the, you do the, well, just make sure this is right. Well, in any case, the composition of these two maps going down, what is that? It's just e to the 2 pi I z over h, right? When you compose, if you first do this, if you first divide by h, and then do e to the 2 pi I of the result, you get e to the 2 pi I z over h, which is q to the 1 over h. So instead of writing your function as a function of q, you can write it as a function of q to the 1 over h. And then the condition that your weakly modular function is holomorphic at infinity, it's again the condition that G is holomorphic, which means that it has a power series expansion in terms of Q to the 1 over H.
G were holomorphic at the origin, well, you just take that holomorphic means or implies that it has a power series, then you plug Q to the 1 over H in, and you get a power series in Q to the 1 over H. So instead of having a Q expansion at infinity, you have a Q to the 1 over H expansion, and then I have to take a root of Q. Okay, that's all. That's the only subtlety. Now we're ready to give the, or I'm ready to give the general definition to you of a modular form. So, okay, so here, let me write it down in words, definition F, where by F I mean a, so F is a weakly modular function for gamma, function of some weight k, or gamma, this is holomorphic at infinity. If when you define this function g as given there, g is holomorphic at zero. So your function on the upper half plane determines the function on the open unit disk as I've indicated, just by inverting these two isomorphisms and then mapping over, and you want that function to be holomorphic at zero. And that's what it means to be holomorphic at infinity. And then holomorphic gives you a power series extension. Hence, in this case, you have a Fourier extension. In this case, F is equal, at least in some tiny neighborhood, I haven't assumed that F is anything more than neuromorphic. F is equal to sum n equals 0 to infinity, some coefficient an, q to the n over h now, sum h. All right, and now finally, I can tell you what it means to be holomorphic at a cusp. So F is holomorphic at a cusp alpha. So this is a cusp for gamma. Well, here's what you do. Let's fix alpha as a particular representative. So here alpha is in Q1 of Q. Consider the function, well, if, that's slightly complicated. Here's what you have to do. You choose an element of SL2Z that sends infinity to alpha. Choose gamma in SL2Z such that gamma of infinity is equal to alpha. And now here's the condition. Condition F bar gamma k is holomorphic at infinity. And it doesn't depend on whether or not it's holomorphic, or actually this function itself doesn't depend on the choice of gamma. Because if you change gamma, if you change gamma by an element, little gamma by an element of capital gamma, that, I have to do a little more work to prove that, so I'll just state that for now. I'm going to give you the definition. So it's holomorphic at a cusp, alpha, if this function is holomorphic at infinity. Notice that this function, well, this thing, this need not be a weakly modular function on gamma. It's just some function. This need not be weakly modular on gamma because f is weakly modular on gamma. That means that f bar bar delta k for any element of gamma, for any element delta in gamma, is equal to f. But this gamma is in SL2Z. There's no reason that F should be invariant under this. F need not be fixed by this. You know, the definition was F bar gamma K equals F for all gamma in capital gamma. That's the definition of weakly modular function. And so this could be some, this will in general be some other function because this gamma here is in SL2Z. Does that make sense? So I'm just saying that there's a subtlety. What is true is that F bar gamma K, that is a weakly modular function for the conjugate subgroup gamma inverse capital gamma gamma. So write that out. Note F bar gamma K is a weakly modular function for
I want to make sure I get the order right. Because it'll be bad if I get it backwards. Yes, so it's. So this is another congruent subgroup. So here's the definition of modular form. Let's see, is there anything I haven't really made clear? So, holomorphic at infinity, yes, please. Tell me what I haven't made
clear. That G is implicitly defined as...
It's really simple.
That takes Q over 1, takes Q to the 1 over H and equals F of Z.
Just think of it, maybe I should just give it completely explicitly. G is the composition of, you take the inverse of the Q function, that gets you to this region in the upper half plane of the 1. Then you map to the region in the upper half plane of an H via the inverse of 1 over H. So that would be Z goes to HC. That's the inverse. This is the inverse of Q. So what is the inverse of e to the 2 pi I Z? I mean functional inverse. So that's, what is that actually? You have to solve, I guess it's a logarithm. So it's a logarithm that's only defined locally. So this map will be log. So log isn't defined everywhere, but it is defined here. So but with some appropriate scaling. So this is Q as a function inverse. So you just compose, G is by definition, you go over, up, and then you apply F. To go to the complex numbers. So G is this composition. Okay? There's nothing mysterious about defining G. It's simply you have a map like this and then over, which these are both isomorphisms, and you're just doing it back in the other direction and composing with F. That's all it is. And the whole point of that is just to go from scary off an infinity behavior to something that you can get your hands on and apply the standard theory to. Okay, think about what I've said so far. Is there anything unclear when I say the phrase F is holomorphic at the cusp alpha? You can also consider the Q to the 1 over H expansion of F at alpha. That means you take a gamma that sends infinity to alpha and it's F bar gamma k. That's a function, and that thing has a 1 over h expansion at infinity. And that's what I mean by the q to the 1 over h expansion of f at alpha. But just think about the phrase f is holomorphic at the cusp alpha. Does that make sense to you now? All it says is f bar gamma k is holomorphic at infinity. And holomorphic at infinity means that this function g is holomorphic at 0. I'm really trying to give you every detail. There's nothing. I do not think I'm sweeping anything under the rug at all, except possibly some very basic properties of the function, of the exponential function. Okay, questions, comments? So finally, we now know what a modular form is. Modular form F of weight K or a congruent subgroup gamma is a holomorphic function F from the upper half plane to C. Such that F bar gamma K is equal to F well, gamma in congruent subgroup gamma, and f is holomorphic at all the cusps for gamma. Okay, so that is the definition and a great deal of generality of a modular form. It's a function that is really, really well behaved and has an inordinate amount of symmetry. So to quote Maser from his Nova special of Fermat's Last Theorem, there is analytic objects that have so much symmetry that they have no right to exist, or something to that effect. And it is very shocking to find out that there are any of these things. And an example, which is a very, very deep example, which I keep coming back to, is you take k equal to 2, take gamma equal gamma 0 of n, and you take an elliptic curve, y squared equals x cubed plus ax plus b, and this curve should have conductor n. Then, if you write down the function sum an 2 to the n, n equals 1 to infinity, where a sub p is p plus 1 minus the number of points on E, under the finite field fp, and you fill in the other a sub n using multiplicativity for the Fourier coefficient, so a sub p q is equal to a sub p times a sub q, and there's another recurrence for power prime powers. A sub p to the r is a sub p times a sub p to the r minus 1 minus p a sub p to the r minus 2. So there's another recurrence for prime powers that don't divide n. And the third recurrence for prime powers that do, you define in an elementary way all these numbers a sub n. This is an example of a modular form. This f, so e, this is a modular form. So it's like one of the deepest theorems of the 20th century.
So what is that function called again for an elliptic curve? Does that especially?
It's simply called the modular form attached to the elliptic curve. Yeah. So I've defined a modular form for you today, mentioned some connections, and then given one very deep example. There are lots of others. Here's another example of level 1, which I think Stark will talk about, or has talked about a lot. This one's kind of neat. I'm just going to write this down just so you can see how you might, like, one construction of a modular form, there'll be others, but you can consider the formal sum over all integers n and n, where you, there's one obvious thing you don't want to include in the sum, so you read it off. That's what the star means. Okay. The star means you don't include the m, both m and n equal to 0. That's all. For a given value of z, you omit the m and n so that this denominator is 0. So this is a function. You can prove that it has nice analytic properties when k is, I think, greater than or equal to 4. And it defines a modular form for SL2z of weight k. It's actually really easy to directly see that this satisfies the condition f bar gamma k equals f. Because if you replace z by az plus b over cz plus d, it just all sort of works out. The denominator, basically you just clear the c, you just multiply it out, you clear the cz plus d, you see that the cz plus d appears over here, and you end up going through exactly the same things in the denominator. So this condition actually just falls out directly if you just plug in for z. You have to, but of course, the hard part here is understanding the analytic behavior of this infinite sum, and that's not really something that goes into this course. But this is an example, so this F here is G sub n. It turns out, remember we have Q expansions, and the Q expansion of this G, I think it's in the notes, is proposition 143, and it's proved by various extremely clever manipulations of power series starting with the power series of cotangent. So you get that GK of Z is equal to the constant term of the Q expansion at infinity is 2 times the Riemann zeta function evaluated at K, the weight. And here, K is an even integer greater than or equal to 4. Sorry. So it's 2 zeta of K plus 2 times 2 pi I to the power of K over K minus 1 factorial times the sum as n goes from 1 to infinity of sigma K minus 1 of n. This is the sum of the K minus first powers of the divisors of n. And Q to the n. That is the Q expansion, the Fourier expansion, at infinity of this particular modular form. Completely explicitly given. So this number theoretic function, the sum of the divisors function, it's hard to get more number theoretic than that function. That is, the, if you just rescale by dividing through by this, the sum of the divisors function, those are the coefficients of the of a modular form. So that's one example of a very interesting arithmetic function from number theory, and it's the coefficients of a modular form. Another obvious interesting example, the coefficients, the point counting on an elliptic curve, these are also the coefficients of a modular form. So it's extraordinary that these analytically defined objects, when you consider the power series of this function g, about zero, has the coefficients have incredibly deep arithmetic meaning, potentially. Well, maybe these aren't so deep. But for the elliptic curve, they are deep. So this is one example of a modular form. Once you have one modular form, you can get quite a lot from it. In fact, just from G4 and G6, you can get every single modular form of level 1, for every modular form for SL2Z. If you have two modular forms, if you multiply them together, you get another modular form. If you add together two modular forms of the same weight, you get another modular form. The set of all modular forms of level 1 is just the algebra generated by G4 and G6. That gives you everything. So, all modular forms of level 1, the algebra of modular forms of level 1, you have to be a little careful about that because not every element of this is a modular form, but basically it's because you can't add things in different ways. But basically, you get everything from taking the polynomial ring in G4 and G6. The smirks on your face suggest maybe Stark has proved this in his class recently. Yeah. I read that in your eyes. Maybe exactly that. He also probably proved the power series expansion. That seems like what he should be doing in there. So, I have a nasty paper cut. Should have a chalkboard paper cut. Dangerous work. These modular forms. So this is how you get all modular forms of level 1. But what about the modular forms of level 2, 3, 5, 4, 6, 7, 8, and so on? How do you get those? And it's not so simple, but that's what I'll tell you more about for the rest of the class. Okay. And if you haven't turned in your midterm already, please do, and also your homework assignments.
To a sarcastic kind of, it's not as harsh as the wall of